org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. First snuggled down here outside D.C. at Coyote Network News World Headquarters, gusts of 35-mile-per-hour winds, but safe compared to the further north, entire eastern seaboard. Dumpsters are floating in Boston, whiteout conditions, wind gusts of 70 miles per hour already have knocked out power as Arctic cold moves in. What can survive such things? And we go, Coyote, Bomba Genesis, what qualities do we most want to cultivate to navigate with jaunty aplomb the wild ride unfurling before us? So more than perfectly, we welcome Dan Flores, author of Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History, that we may glean knowledge which leads to respect and honoring and partnering with our ingenious, wily, playful, trickster intelligence ally, which likes against all odds. Flores is the author of over 10 books, recipient of innumerable awards, and spiraling stories out into the memosphere in innumerable media venues, of which the Visionary Activist Show is delighted to be included. He held the A.B. Hammond Chair in Western History at the University of Montana in Missoula, Montana, until he retired in May 2014, making him even more available to the world. He lives outside Santa Fe, New Mexico, from where he joins us now. Welcome, Dan Flores.
Hello, Caroline. I'm very happy to be with you.
That's great. So I should do a disclaimer, you know, first, because I have lived with an actual half coyote for 19 years, longer than I've lived with a human. While fully aware that these hybrids, I do not necessarily approve. We don't want people to keep coyotes as pets or to breed them because it's dodgy. But it was an assignment, and I've learned a great deal, and I'm inextricably wedded in my appreciation and delight. And it was so wonderful to learn even more from Coyote America. So I love this part of Mary Oliver. She has a poem, Singing in Praise, and it ends with, I sing in praise to the coyote that came at me with its strong teeth bared and then at the last moment smiled. And I find that very coyote-ish, and for my own living circumstance. So off we go. I love you referring to them as avatars, stand-ins to help humans see themselves and ghosts of the continent's ancient past, and that they were here long before we were, and that we borrow qualities from them. So maybe yes, you say, in Aztecs, the Aztec city of Tenochtitlan, a millennium ago, the urban coyotes were cahooting, right?
They were indeed. Yes, I think from the time they first encountered humans, which could have been as long ago as 15,000 years, they sort of quickly took our measure, and they realized that they could live amongst us, that there were benefits to doing so, because they basically prey primarily on mice and rats. And of course, our villages, our towns, our cities produce a surplus of those animals. And so they probably began hanging around human camps from the very beginning, as soon as people began arriving in North America. And we've got good evidence from the ancient Aztec capital that coyotes were an urban animal more than 1,000 years ago. So this phenomenon of having coyotes in our cities and having them trot through our yards is not something new under the sun.
Yeah, and they do show up as agents of synchronicity. It's poignant to me that since Stella Coyote, who lived to be 19 years, 2 months, and 2 weeks, pretty good, has died, I haven't seen or heard one, which is unusual. I'm still waiting, because I know they're around Washington, D.C., because they're everywhere, and we've seen the the wonderful photos of them riding on the train in Chicago and in the cooler on a hot day in the convenience store. And one of the things that you bring up, which I love, is that the fish and fusion, that they can be solitary and they can also be in packs, which is a evolutionary adaptive advantage, right?
It is indeed. It's one of the this fish and fusion adaptation comes out of probably their long coevolution beside gray wolves, which were pretty and still are pretty mortal enemies of coyotes. Now, this is distinctive from the wolves of the east, which are a different and more continental-based wolf. But the gray wolf of the American West has long been an enemy of coyotes, and that seems to be where this adaptation of the fish and fusion lifestyle came from. And as you know, I point out in the book, one of the interesting things about that lifestyle, that ability to live both as a social animal and to go it alone or as pairs, is that it mirrors one of our own adaptations to the world. Humans are one of the very few other mammals in the world that do the fish and fusion strategy. And in our case, it's helped us to avoid major disease epidemics and die-offs in our long evolutionary past. And for coyotes, it's basically made it possible for them to withstand harassment by wolves. And then in the last couple of hundred years, harassment by us. And that's one of the reasons, the fact that they can do this, that under pressure that attempted to poison them into oblivion 100 years ago, and even more recently than that, the result basically was that it spread them across North America. Whenever they go into fission mode, they tend to scatter across the landscape and colonize. And so our attempts to pressure them and basically to eradicate them is, in fact, what, ironically enough, has spread them across the United States.
Right, because you mentioned part of their ingenious adaptability is kind of measuring the environmental holding, right? So, you know, if they will breed and have pups that are, you know, the right small size to do, but if they're eradicated or if there's a war against them, then they can have up to 19 pups in a litter. You're right.
Yes, they can definitely have larger litters whenever they're being harassed. And Are you there?
I'm here. You were cutting out for a moment, but we will invite Coyote Trickster to help us in our communication. May it be smooth, oh, coyotes. Because one of my, you know, kind of astro-mytho dynamics is, you know, what is unique to our rogue species aside from our bad manners? And I think it's the assignment, the responsibility and necessity to borrow qualities of intelligence from our flora and fauna kin on this planet. And so I've just been assigned to go, yeah, the coyote ingenuity and wit and telepathy and ingenuity is we need this now, because it does, you know, Trickster loves against all odds. It's parts of us don't, but Trickster loves that thing. And noticing, because I also lived with a hybrid wolf for a long time, and they worked out a great friendship, but coyotes love seesaws, right? They love unstable footing. Dogs not so much, right? They love that unstable footing. They love a challenge. They do make jokes. They have all kinds of, I was, you know, because Stella Coyote, all she got from her mom was size, and, you know, the wild really genetically dominates. And so people would always say, what do you got there? And some would, on the East Coast, think that she was a fox. And I'd sort of go, oh, something wild might have gone over the fence. But then I go, well, we just can't hide this. You're an ambassador between worlds. Because people would come up and say, we used to hunt those things, but she sure is a pretty little critter. Anyway, so I go, it's Stella Coyote's goodwill tour. And then part of what you mentioned, certainly, and what I've noticed is not only, well, the adaptogen, the adaptogenic capacity, the omnivore capacity. Because people would often say, you know, how long do those critters live? And I go, that's kind of a rude question. But we'd never had a coyote that I know of anyway, who had opportunity for a very broad range of food. She'd eat, but she had a banana phase that she was wild about. Coconut milk, but, you know, meat, yes, yes. But this fantastic wide variety of try this, right? And that's something that you note as a you know, desirable adaptogenic intelligence, right?
Well, yes, there's no question. And I think the experience you had with your coyote is mirrored in the wild world. I mean, coyotes are famous for being omnivorous, for eating a astonishing variety of things, which is one of the reasons that they have done so well in so many different habitats. I mean, they're now in everything from polar habitats above the Arctic Circle down to the jungles of Central America, and in every single state in the United States except for Hawaii. And in many of those places, they've had to look for new sources of food. I mean, in Chicago, for example, they've famously been chasing and eating geese along the lakeshore and also specializing in eating geese eggs. And in many parts of the country, coyotes are legendary for eating fruit. Whenever fruit trees produce their fruit, coyotes are often photographed, gathered around them. So, yeah, I think the animal that you had is probably an indication of that ability out in the world to kind of be, in effect, a locavore, really, and to make it work no matter where they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And just for the vegans out there, one of her favorite things was chia pudding, as well as, you know, buffalo. So we love that. And then, you know, you go back, you take us back 10,000 years ago. You know, Indians designed the avatar form of coyote as a principal deity, you know, who creates all of North America. And you mentioned, you know, old man coyote as usual. The old woman coyote is somewhere there. But I love Mayan allies referring to myself and others as Weiwei Coyotes, you know, revered ancient coyote, and we go, oh, we love that thing. But you say coyote is a Darwinian mirror, an American original, edgier and more ironic. I love that. Yes, I do think they have irony, and we want to bring up all kinds of pranks. But maybe you could unfold a little bit about what you mean by coyotes are a Darwinian mirror.
Well, I use that term because there are so many instances where when we look at coyotes and understand them, and I think that's a critical thing that as Americans we've struggled with a bit, but if we look closely at them and understand them, know something about their natural history, know something about their evolution, what you see when you look in that mirror is often the human face looking back, because there are so many of their traits that mirror our own. Part of their success in the world, in fact, which of course is a mirror of our own success, has to do with the fact that both of us, both species, coyotes and ourselves, have managed to dominate our worlds primarily through intelligence. And so as we look at them, what we see is kind of an uber animal of the wild that mirrors our own animal nature. And I think that's why 10,000 years ago, when native people had an opportunity to pick from a wide array of very impressive animals, some of them very large, charismatic species, as the deity that they thought was responsible for creating the continent, it was a coyote that they picked. It was this animal that survived the Pleistocene extinctions, that lived by its wits. It wasn't the largest animal. It wasn't a looming creature. It was an animal that they saw that lived and survived in much the same way that humans did. And so out of that, of course, came the oldest literary body of work that's associated with North America, these coyote stories that go back probably 10,000 years. There are hundreds of them. And as you've mentioned a couple of times, they do portray the coyote as something of a trickster animal. But I argue in the book, in the chapter that I called Old Man America, which is about this deity coyote, that the really important part of these stories is not the trick, it's why the tricks work. And those stories are designed to illuminate for us our own human nature. That's what the coyote stories are really about. They're not simply stories about tricksters. They're stories about an animal that is using a kind of a tricky nature in order to illustrate who we are as human beings. And that's another reason, I think, that when we look in the mirror at the coyote, the image that's projected back is often the image of ourselves.
No, that's great. And I refer to trickster coyote as keeper of democracy, meaning those very skills we need. Because, yeah, and then the trickster, I mean, having lived with again, Stella Coyote from 6 weeks to 19 years, trickster, absolutely. I mean, we've taught dogs shame. Coyotes have zero shame at all. But there is a wheel and deal that I like to kind of extrapolate into an indigenous spirituality. It's a wheel and deal. I give you this, you give me that. You know, and you mentioned later in the book about an intrinsic sort of egalitarianism that they know, like many animals and us, when they're being treated unfairly. You know, it's an internal sense. But there is a wheel and deal. I mean, Stella Coyote would steal, not her word, you know, everything, two pairs of, you know, a pair of gloves, but she would then drop one in front of me going, you want your friend's glove back? You know, what are you offering me for the other? It was very, very clear. And I'd go, some pate, and she'd hold out going, okay, two. And then she'd bring the glove back, you know. But it was all wheel and deal. And I think that, you know, as a model, it's kind of, you know, may all of our engagements with plants and animals and each other be of reciprocal benefit. And part of the deal, you know, when Stella was a puppy and she was an incredible escape artist, oh my God, she didn't want to go far. It was a game, you know. But I said, okay, we've given up quite a lot. You would like 60 square miles, you know, but although you're half dog too, you know, and I've given up a lot. But as she got older, 17, 18, 19, and was still pretty great, and in the last months we provided medical cannabis, which was a perfect pain alleviator that gave her another 6 months of pleasure. But I go, all right, it's paying off right now, because now I can give you what nature wouldn't, which is a safe old age. And, you know, nature would probably not do that. And so I viewed that, you know, our experiment, you know, was a to and fro. It did ultimately balance out. But have you observed also this to and fro, wheel and deal kind of thing?
Well, one of the stories I tell fairly early in the book, and I return to it in the epilogue, is the story of one of the early naturalists who was describing coyotes. In this particular instance, he was a Spanish naturalist, and it's one of our first records of a European attempting to describe a coyote. And he expresses the usual sort of ambiguity that old worlders brought to the coyote, because they had no animal like that. They had wolves and bears and so forth, and were familiar with all those, but they didn't have coyotes. And so this was an animal that confused a lot of Europeans, and this particular naturalist said, you know, we don't know if it's a fox, if it's a jackal, if it's some kind of wolf. He sort of speculated that it probably was some sort of small wolf, which was a pretty good guess. But one of the stories he told about it, and this is in the very first European account of the coyote, and so it was translated into several languages and widely read back in Europe, was he said the coyote is this animal, he said, is a particular avenger of injuries, but it also remembers those who have done well by it, and it will always repay the favor in the future. And right, that's a thought about these animals that I think answers to the Wheeler Dealer story you were just telling. And as I said, it's one that I use fairly early in the book, but I return to it in the epilogue because I think it's something to keep in mind. I think it's a pretty good insight about coyotes in general, and something to keep in mind about these animals. They are, they take revenge for injury, but they also pay attention when people do well by it, and they return that in kind.
Yeah, and I wouldn't want to be on the revenge end of the coyote, because they are so intriguing that way. Yeah, and the wheel and deal, yeah, the avengers of injuries. Apparently orcas also will remember a human who has harmed them or something and go, oh, you, and can pick them out. And we go, right. So it is, you know, it is a time. I mean, as you gaze at the world and the war on life, and even now the more drilling opened up by the Dementors, even as they tear themselves apart, you know. But do you have... do you have a jaunty, coyote, plucky confidence that, you know, coyotes will prevail, that we who love life will prevail? Do you draw on your own inner coyote?
Well, I do. I'm optimistic about coyotes because there's every reason to be. They've demonstrated with lots of evidence that they can take every shot we dish out to them, and as a species, they can keep on going. But I tend to be optimistic about the fact that we're gradually coming to a new awareness of who we are, our role in the world. And I think that coyotes are going to be right there as teachers of this. All we have to do as Americans is to pay more attention to these indigenous animals. I mean, the coyotes' progenitors go back in North America 5.3 million years. And the coyote itself has been here for... I mean, it evolved into its present form about 800,000 years ago. So what we have to do, I think, and to me, I think there are plenty of us out in the world who are doing this, is to pay attention to an animal that has been in place long before we were here and try to learn how to be Americans from it. I think the more we know about coyotes, the more American we become.
That's great. No, I'm completely up for that. And the things I've gathered along the way, also, I remember seeing a hidden camera in the woods watching trappers laying traps and coyotes stealthily walking behind them. And then as the trappers moved on, the coyotes took a stick and sprung the trap and then just for attitudinal flourish, peed all over it. I go, I love that.
Yeah.
As part of our own skill set, follow the trappers, spring the trap so it hurts nobody, and then pee all over it. And I go, that's part of our training, part of a great attitude, you know. And I'm so delighted, again, that you say these avengers of injury and keepers of so much and ingenuity and teachers who have been here so long before us. You know, and you talk about problem-solving ingenuity, right, the springing of traps, and successful in change. And as you just mentioned, the canid 5 million years of evolution. Respect our elders, respect our elders. So I know you're part of, you know, you're an ambassador, you're an honored part of Project Coyote, which is based, I guess, in the Bay Area, which is educational to help humans come into accord rather than polarized animosity. Yeah? Oops, Dan.
Mel Fox, who founded Project Coyote. Very proud to be affiliated with it. And one of the is about to happen.
Whoops, you're slightly breaking up. We wonder, are you there?
Am I there now?
Oh, you are.
Am I there?
Yes, you're there. Let's
okay.
Have Coyote guide you to the right spot so we can hear you. There you are. You're steady again.
Right. I'm 17 miles outside Santa Fe, so my signal is not always the best. But what I was saying was that I'm proud to be affiliated with Project Coyote and with Camilla Fox, who's the founder of that organization. And Camilla and I, in fact, are going to appear this coming weekend in Nevada City for the premiere of her film, The Killing Games, which is about these coyote hunting contests that take place all over the country. And so we're hoping that Project Coyote's film is going to do some good in trying to turn this around. I mean, killing these animals, these expressive, intelligent animals for sport and for bets is a horrible breach of a civilized world. And California has been the only state so far to put these coyote hunting contests aside. Many other states, including New Mexico, where I live, still do it. And so we're hoping that this film and some more enlightenment of the public about these marvelous animals is going to help turn the tide on this.
Yeah, well, is it going to be a necessary but really difficult film to watch? Are we going to see many coyote corpses and all of that?
Well, I will say that somewhat like my book, Coyote America, there are parts that will be difficult to sit through, but it's really kind of critical that one does. I mean, the film is by no means a snuff film. You're not going to see lots of animals dying. It's primarily a film that shows the beauty and resilience of these animals. But there will be parts that will be a little bit difficult for people to watch. As I said, very much like my book. I mean, when I described the invention during World War II of a whole suite of new poisons to kill coyotes more slowly because they're so intelligent that they see cause and effect between poisons like strychnine that kill them quickly. I mean, that's been difficult for quite a number of readers to get through. But I think it's essential to know about. It's the kind of thing that enrages you when you understand that it's happening. And the same is true, I think, of some small parts of this film.
No, that's crucial. We got to know everything. It's like Ally Chris Jordan's incredible photographs of the albatross on Midway Island, dead and decaying, filled with plastic. Our lighters, our bottle caps, our bit. We got to know. Absolutely.
Yeah. Nobody's doing this gratuitously. I can promise you that. We're doing it because it's one of those truths of the world that you sort of have to look in the eye.
Right. No, we do. We got to know what we're doing. It's like fully informed compassion going, oh, all right, you know, and therefore, coyotes would want to know. Coyotes want to know about everything. That's true. And so the strychnine, and even, you know, when I would take Stella Coyote out and on rare occasion when I didn't have to be anywhere soon, you know, let her romp, like, okay. But hunters would come up and go, you know, there's a bounty on those things. I'm like, oh, humans, okay. Right, so there is that. Yeah, and Camilla Fox, yeah, I love her. Her father met Stella Coyote, and he said, oh, animals love me, coyotes love me, and Stella would have none of it. She was like, ah, rah, 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 rah. They're great suckers of confidence. Going, you say we love you? Ha ha ha! No, we don't. So yeah, and there's so many. And you mentioned a really great thing. We're going to take a very short coyote break in a moment. But I loved also the resonance too. You say, you know, animal deities throughout history, animal gods, coyote with the primary deity. You know, but 4,000 years ago, the Greeks replaced the animal deities with humans, and we go, that's an interesting moment that we might want to return to, you know, because the animal deities are, you know, probably part of our harmonious, respectful accord in that realm. Do you want to start to respond, and then we're going to go to coyote voices in a moment there? But I love that the animal gods, and then 4,000 years ago, the Greeks replaced the animal deities. Is that a fork in the road? Is that something we want to return to?
Well, I think it probably was a fork in the road. I mean, there have been a lot of forks in the road in the human story, and that certainly was one. Yeah, I think, you know, as I discuss in the epilogue of the book, you know, there's a possibility that we may begin to do some of those old Aztec kind of ceremonies where people donned coyote masks and ears and tails and celebrated the coyote nature of the human of human existence. And so it's a way, I think, to plug ourselves back into the natural world, because we come out of the natural world, but we've not made a complete exit from it. There's still a way back. There's still a way home. And this is one of the avenues, I think.
That's great. All right, everybody got your coyote mask. That's right. Okay, so our splendid guest who will be with us after this very short coyote break, it's a public service announcement from coyotes, and I ran this by my cats. They loved it. So it's wonderfully intense, you know, but I love it. It's music to my ears. And, you know, as our wonderful guest Dan Flores, author of Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History, which is crucial to intimacy with our world and to democracy, I feel. And we will be right back after this very short coyote public service announcement.
Ah!
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and that was our Coyote public service announcement. Just us broadcasting coyotes out there to our kinned coyotes and see how your dogs liked it, or that my cats loved it. They were like, oh, I love that thing. Oddly, because it would have been dangerous. But our splendid, perfect for today guest is Dan Flores. He is author of Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History, something we really want. I love this book. And you can find out more about his dedicated work also with Camilla Fox at projectcoyote.org. So can you decode any of those yips, Dan Flores?
I thought that was a great public service announcement, by the way. You know, I don't speak coyote, and I'm not sure when I look in their eyes that I can actually decipher very much of what they're thinking. I think it's sort of hubris to assume that one can. So I'll have to say that while I enjoyed every musical note of it and understood very well why the Aztecs made the coyote one of their gods, was the coyote was the god of poetry, because poetry, of course, is a musical language. I nonetheless did not understand it any more than I sometimes understand poetry.
Right, and I guess, you know, living with my between worlds, Stella Coyote, for 19 years, we could pretty much tell what each other were thinking, but I do not presume to be able to decode their language or to speak it well. Yeah, you know, and when I try and screech in, you know, or caw caw, you know, with crows, I go, I apologize for not speaking your language well, but there is a sincere desire. And again, you know, as we look around the world and what does it mean that some humans, although you and your work and all of us, you know, hoping to change that adversarial cruelty, the, you know, the poisoning by strychnine and then slower moving poisons that you describe in the book, and the death by strychnine is horrific, and we go, no, just humans. But, you know, to borrow these qualities of intelligence, and it really is, you know, one of my primary dedications to admire and borrow the quality of this trickster ingenuity. But it's interesting in your book also, you say that, you know, long originally, you know, coyote's very wary, because Stella Coyote, no human had been mean to her because she was born down the street to a imprisoned coyote and a dog, but very wary. And I'd assume that it was only the wary that had survived, and I was always apologizing to her people for what our people had done, the traps, the poison, the, all of that. But you say it's intrinsic to their nature even before humans as adversaries. Is that right?
It is intrinsic to their nature because of the relationship they had with the bigger dog, the gray wolf. And so, I mean, since gray wolves returned to North America 25 or 30,000 years ago, coyotes, which were, of course, in the West originally until we spread them across the country, coyotes and gray wolves didn't get along well. It was the classic big dog, small dog kind of relationship where the small dog tends to get beat up quite a bit. And so that's why they develop this wariness, almost sometimes a nervousness. It came about because of their relationship with wolves. Their relationship with us has been briefer, and for the first, well, for probably almost the first 15,000 years of it, up until about 200 years ago, they had really nothing to fear from humans. They only learned to fear humans beginning in the 19th century when European Americans arrived on the scene and began basically killing them and poisoning them largely for the fur trade. So they've actually had a very, very long period of time with us where they haven't thought of us as enemies at all. And I sort of suspect that's one of the reasons that coyotes in cities fairly quickly develop an ability to circulate among humans without being very alarmed, because their kind of close and easy association with human beings goes back 15,000 years.
I guess so does wolves too. And it was kind of reciprocal. These old relationships. You know, the wolves, you give us cooked meat, we chase the saber-toothed tigers out of the cave, kind of thing. And I guess the coyotes, you mentioned a great thing, you know, in the midst of the war on life and the war on wild beings, you mentioned also that there was, you know, an article that said farmers pray for coyotes now, right? Because they eliminated the rabbits and the things eating the farmers' grains, and so that was a anomalous harmonious moment, right?
It was an anomalous moment, but it was an early kind of personal experience that these particular farmers I was talking about in the territory of Utah in the 1880s realized and drew the correct conclusion about, which was that by trying to eradicate coyotes in their midst, what they had done was to unleash rabbits and rats in their fields. And so they quickly sort of formed the connection between fewer coyotes and greater numbers of these animals that were eating their crops. But it was the kind of recognition that not very many Americans were willing to make for most of the 19th and 20th centuries. I mean, we didn't really know what to think about coyotes because we hadn't had the experience of living amongst them in Europe. And so in the 19th century, the way I track the story is that a lot of the early encounters with coyotes, like the one that Lewis and Clark have in 1804, which gives coyotes, by the way, the first name that Americans knew them by, which was the prairie wolf. That's what Lewis and Clark named them. They had never heard the ancient Aztec name, coyote. And so they called them prairie wolves. And that's what most Americans knew coyotes by for really until about the 1860s or so. But their kind of response, the American response in the 19th century was, at least until Mark Twain wrote Roughing It in the early 1870s, was, we didn't really know what to think about them. They looked like smaller versions of wolves, but they didn't seem to be quite big enough to be threats to very much livestock, certainly not cattle. And so there's a period in a lot of the 19th century where the American response is more curiosity than anything else. And then Mark Twain writes that, in one way, wonderfully comic kind of rant about coyotes and Roughing It, but in another way, he characterizes them as such sort of despicable, cowardly characters, and it's Mark Twain, so he goes on for three pages having a lot of fun with this, but what it means is that, I mean, that book was a bestseller, and so the American reading public finally had a way to think about coyotes other than just curiosity. And the way Mark Twain instructed us to think about them was that they were just breathing up good air. He said, a self-respecting flea would abandon a coyote for a velocipede. So it created this period from the 1870s into the 20th century when we almost, our American writers almost compete with one another trying to come up with the best sort of derogatory explication of coyote presence in our midst. And yeah, it reaches a point by 1920 where a writer calls them the original Bolshevik and says we ought to shoot them on sight for patriotic reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, truly, we are all befoiled because Mark Twain, we're grateful to him for many things. You know, worry is not preparation, and I've experienced many terrible things, most of which never came to pass. But he was befoiled in that realm, and he also, when he went to Syria, he spoke of Syrians in that way too. We go, oh, you're good, and he was part Native American himself, but so we go, okay, so the dissing of Syrians, the dissing of coyotes, the easy mark, and then it catches on, because being snookered into having an enemy again, we want to throw that into the cauldron, and so some relief, so how do you feel now? I mean, you've been so welcomed, and your work and this beautiful book, Coyote America, Natural and Supernatural History. I was looking at your media. That's right. We're grateful to have you here. That's media, many mainstream media things and not. So do you feel an enhanced receptivity to a kind of respectful, eager to be informed thing out there?
I do feel that, yes. The book has attracted a lot of attention, I think, in part because we're all dealing with coyotes all over the country. I mean, if I had written this book 50 years ago, you know, it probably wouldn't have resonated because people on the Atlantic coast, people east of the Mississippi River, would have thought of this animal as purely a Western animal and not their concern. But today, I mean, there are coyotes in Queens. There are coyotes in Central Park. There are coyotes in Boston. There are coyotes in Chicago, by the thousands in Chicago, in Atlanta, in every major city in the country, not to mention, of course, San Francisco and Los Angeles and Denver, some of the cities where I talk about the history of coyotes as part of the urban fauna. And I think the reason that the book has resonated is because, interestingly enough, people are seeing these animals. There are certainly urban legends about them that they're hearing, but I think the American reading public knows that, by and large, they don't know anything about coyotes. And here was an opportunity to have a book in front of them that could give them something to go on so that they knew something about this animal.
Yes. And I hope that sound is a coyote reconnecting your phone. There we go. Are you there, Dan?
I'm here, yes.
Oh, excellent. That's good. Okay, cutting in and out. But we prevail. Our coyote selves prevail. Yeah, you mentioned that the population in greater Los Angeles is over 5,000 coyotes. And we go, that's good. And they're all writing screenplays. So because they are that adaptogenic, we love that thing. And it is very much, you know, it's like I found an old essay I wrote and I'm re-bringing to light in 1989. I go, that's pretty good, talking about humans and the natural world and the rainforest, and will we find the thing that heals us before we kill it? And that's right now here. You know, what does it mean in our collective, you know, earthly intelligence? Yeah, I was talking to somebody who's, you know, really dedicated to polar bears, as you are dedicated to coyotes, and me too. You know, anything, because of the polar bear is a top predator, it's top curiosity. We'll come back to coyotes, which are top curiosity for other reasons. You know, and the famous photo of the Russian submarine surfacing next to a polar bear, and the polar bear goes over there going, yeah, you know, what the hell are you? And what does it mean that, you know, that top intelligence is, you know, under attack by what humans are unleashing on the world? And then, you know, so coyotes are among the most curious and ingenious, and it's not from being top predator. You mentioned it. It's this interesting kind of hybrid of being both prey and predator that has created this incredibly supple and witty intelligence, right? So again, I mean, is it one of your great allies, the coyote? Are you coyote-ish? Have you adopted qualities?
Well, I don't know if I've adopted many coyote, certainly not trickster qualities, but I certainly watch them closely and try to learn from them, because I think one of the things they are able to teach me is how to be human. I mean, that's part of my avatar argument in the book, is that they mirror us so well and represent us, our own evolutionary history and our adaptation so well in the world, that when we watch them, we can not only learn about them, but we can learn about ourselves too. And I mean, I think that's what the old man coyote stories are about. I think that's in a lot of ways what Wile E. Coyote was about in the cartoons in the late 20th century. He was every man, and he was teaching us about ourselves.
Right, and then you do. It was good. I like running across like what things, because you do a kind of homage to Walt Disney, and you mention his first anti hunting film Bambi. Which was the first movie I ever saw, and I was like, "Oh, that was terribly sad." But you said that Walt Disney was actually pretty good for coyotes.
Well, he did 6 pro coyote films in the 1960s and 1970s at a time when no one else was doing that. And on Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color, starting in 1961, a film called A Coyote's Lament appeared. I was 12 years old at the time. Watching that film in my parents' living room, and became absolutely entranced with coyotes, because what Disney tried to do with it, as he said, was Mark Twain has told us how we're supposed to look at coyotes and what the story of the coyote is from the human point of view. I want to tell the story of the West from the coyote's point of view. I thought that was a remarkable thing to do when I was 12. I still think it is. And so, I think those Walt Disney films managed to begin to change many Americans who watched them in the 60s and 70s and became a part of the age of ecology that sort of shifted the whole consciousness of the country about how to react to our wild kin.
That's great. We're doing it. We're doing a coyote thing because you have changed my opinion of Walt Disney. We love change. We love changing our minds. That's really great. It's like, okay, all right, I'm going to go find those films. And you have a great, you know, a great guiding again in your book, Coyote America, Natural and Supernatural History. Many, many references. And even though, you know, I know a fair amount, but many things I didn't know, which I'll add. And then also curiously too, because, you know, the intimate and the, you know, and the studying in different forms. But, you know, you mentioned again, well, coyotes, you know, the 10,000 years ago, they made an evolutionary decision in a way, which is they shrank, which was ingenious. But you also mentioned that, you know, their eyes, you know, do not perceive color, right? And I'm not,
right, correct.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure, you know, and who knows, really, because one of the big adventures, because I had a hybrid wolf, and when I irresistibly couldn't not adopt Stella Coyote between worlds person, the wolf was just appalled because their customs were very different. We'd get into bed, and the coyote would go, "It's one thing to make it perfect, let me pee in a circle around you," and even I and the wolf were like, "That's disgusting." But every night at 2 a.m., she would run around the house and gather things from all over, rocks and sticks and things, and put them in a circle and then throw them in the air and animate them and then run around and kill them, and then she would run around and bite me and the wolf dog. And so I was like, whoa. And the wolf dog was like, oh no, it's 2 a.m. again, she's gonna do this thing, what does it mean? So I did actually put my head to her head and I go, here's our deal, I can see you're a great artist, so, you know, I will give you art supplies, right? And you know, but in return, you know, and you're going to have food, you know, and you love the moondog who doesn't love you, but you love him. And in return, you don't need to do this bitey thing at night. And she didn't. She did many other, you know, terrible things, but not that thing. But I had to keep up my end of the deal, right? Because, you know, again, they're very balancy that way. And so providing her with, you know, colored bits of cloth and stuff. And she seemed to like bright colors. I'd put out brown and black, but she'd always choose yellow. I mean, are we sure they don't see colors, or what else could it be?
I think she was seeing saturations. And so yellow would be a more saturated appearance in the gray scheme than brown would.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so yeah, so like the saturation.
I think that's what she was probably seeing. But, I mean, that's a great story. So did you make her a great artist?
She was a great artist. She had, well, because I got backstage, right? And as great at destruction, I didn't have anything that was not, you know, eaten. And she would bide her time to wait for a moment of inattention to get the leather wallet, to get the thing, you know, whatever. But she was also a great creator. And so I did get this backstage thing. And, you know, in winter, she would go out into the yard and go into a very ancient place. And if I came up too fast, she would be like just a wild beast. And I'd have to come up into the, invite her into the modern world. But she did make Tom Brown survival huts, or Tom Brown made coyote huts, meaning I would find that she would have found curved branches and then covered those with leaves and then more curved branches and then leaves and back in, so only her little nose was out, you know, and it's about, you know, 20 to 30 degrees warmer in there. And we go, oh, that's so ingenious, that's so, and it was so beautiful. She also lined her den, the archway into her den, with stones, with her little pointy nose. And I go, you created cathedrals. You did all this stuff. So I do feel, as a reporter, going, there's all this incredible intelligence and culture and ingenuity that we don't necessarily know about, but I got this backstage kind of a deal. And she, I would give her balls of string, and she would wrap it into mandala patterns around furniture legs and all that kinds of stuff. And we go, Wow. Not like a dog. I've never seen a dog do such a thing. So she would destroy and also create. But again, you know, I think, you know, part of your beautiful dedication is the more we know, the more respect we have going, you know, and I think your book is so great that way because nobody minds being asked, did you know? I mean, did you know about this, about coyotes? Did you know about, you know, and your book is full of that. And I think, you know, that idea is, you know, was that one of your kind of dedicated missions to inform people and therefore increase respect, which means to look at again, which is a good thing. Let's look at this again to really, you know, change the knee-jerk Mark Twain-inspired, you know, animosity into collaboration. And even, I guess, with farmers who are like, but they kill our sheep. What do you say to the farmers about the sheep killing?
Well, I say, in effect, that if you raise sheep, you probably have to factor in from the very outset that unless you go to significant lengths to prevent it, you're going to lose some animals to the predators of the natural world. That's the way domestic stock raising has been for 8,000 years. And it's going to remain that way unless you just decide that we're going to completely eradicate all the wild in the world. And unfortunately, there are too many of us in the world who find value in the wild for someone to really be able to get away with something like that in modern circumstances. So I think if you raise stock, you simply have to factor in that this is part of the game. You're going to lose a few animals to predators, but it's a wonderful thing to have the predators out there. And, of course, there are all sorts of new and innovative strategies to lower those losses to a bare minimum. I mean, Camilla Fox in Marin County has come up with several strategies that have worked very well to the point where Wildlife Services has not been a player in Marin County for a while. Wildlife Services being the descendant of the government agency that since the early 20th century has been taking care of.
Right, and we will intuit the end of your sentence because it faded away. That Wildlife Services has. Can you repeat that? Up, Dan Flores, come in, Dan Flores.
I'm here.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
good,
I'm listening
good.
To you.
Oh, no, that's great. No, the phone cut out at the very end of your sentence. That Wildlife Services have what?
Yeah. Okay. So let me repeat that. Wildlife Services is the descendant of the government agency that, beginning in 1915, presented itself to America as the solution to the predator problem. It's gone under several names. It started out as the Biological Survey. Today, it's called Wildlife Services, and it's still with us. And they still kill something like 70,000 to 80,000 coyotes a year on behalf of the American sheep industry.
Right. Yeah, and I guess there's llamas and other things you could do. And one of the things that, you know, again, the coyote part of Stella Coyote was that she did think it was very witty to come up behind people and nip their ankles, counting coup, going, I could have severed your Achilles tendon. you know, and that's also why when she escaped, I was like, no, you don't want to meet the authorities. My job was to keep her safe from the authorities. But you can see how, you know, two or three coyotes could easily take down a big animal because they're relentless. You know, and there is some of that dedication too. If coyotes want something, they're relentless. But we should also say to humans who encounter them that coyotes are not sentimental and they do not respect weakness. You know, so if you encounter coyotes and you go, ooh, 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 they go, let me help you out of your misery by killing you. But if you go, hi there, how are you? They're like, hey, how you doing? So I think making squealing sounds is not good. Yeek, yeek, yeek. They're like, let me help you out. And you mentioned, I mean, there have been two deaths, I suppose, of humans from coyotes in notable American history recently. There was, we don't know. I don't quite know how that would happen. Do you know about those particular deaths?
Well, of course, I write about them in the book. Yes, I mean, one happened in California in 1983 when a toddler was killed by a coyote. The child had wandered out onto the driveway early one morning as a coyote trotted by, and the coyote attacked it. And the other one is was the death of a 19-year-old woman in Canada in 2009.
Right. Folks, yeah.
But, you know, I would say that it's in some ways that's just kind of the mathematical odds, and they are extraordinarily low. Many, many more people get bitten by dogs a year than ever get even have a hint of a threat from coyotes. I mean, coyotes are just not really dangerous to people.
No, mostly curious and wheel and deal and what's up and don't attack my land or my pups. And I do love, okay, we're on our way out here, but I do love, I'm very grateful to you and your book, Dan Flores, Coyote America, Natural and Supernatural History. And I love that you end with the novelty-seeking super genius coyote that they've learned everything, and coyote consciousness is something we all want to embrace, right?
That's exactly yes. Right, and that is how I end the book, too.
That is a wonderful thing. That is how the book ends, and it's a brilliant book and a useful book. And thanks so much to Erica Bridgman and Berkeley, our great board op. And thank you again, Dan Flores. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week in CoyoteNetworkNews.com for free Epiphany Zoom call, all kinds of things on the website. Woof, woof, woof. Yep, yep, yep. Thanks, Dan Flores.
Are you wanting support to resolve conflicts in your life?
Do you wish you were better at creating a peaceful and just world?
On Talk It Out Radio, Sundays from 7 to 8 p.m., we offer the skills of self-compassion,
effective communication,
and creating understanding across differences.
Come listen, call in, and practice with us.
Talk It Out.
Talk It Out.
Talk It Out Radio, Sundays, 7 to 8 p.m. on KPFA.
2018, KPFA has organized some timely events with serious political authors. Beginning in January, in the robust spirit of Black Lives Matter, Kat Brooks gets with BLM founder Patrice Cullors to discuss her book, When They Call You a Terrorist. The 1st of February, Daniel Ellsberg and Larry Bensky will talk about Dan's urgent new work, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Then Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz will present Loaded, a disarming history of the Second Amendment, meaning guns. Richard Wolff will then view the ominous wry decline of U.S. capitalism. To greet springtime, Michio Kaku will provide a startling new perspective he calls the future of humanity, terraforming Mars, interstellar travel, immortality, and our destiny beyond Earth. Find out much more about these events on the KPFA website.
Why should the black man in America concern himself, since we've been away from the African continent for 400 years, 300 or 400 years? Why should we concern ourselves? What impact does what happened to them have upon us? Number one.
For news, information, and analysis about Africa and the African diaspora, tune in weekly on Mondays at 7 p.m. to Africa Today with your host, Walter Turner. Africa Today is your source for being up to date on Africa and African. Mondays at 7 p.m., Africa Today on your Pacifica radio station, KPFA 90.